Hi and welcome to the Biographics Podcast. I am your host, Simon Whistler, and in today's episode, we've got another one we've taken from our YouTube channel. If there are any sort of weird abnormalities, because this is the taking of a video from YouTube and the rebroadcasting of the audio in a podcast form, if there's anything weird and funky, that's probably just because it was intended for a video audience first, but hopefully you will enjoy it all the same. Let's roll into today's episode.
The Thought Police, Big Brother, Room 101. Even if you've never heard the name George Orwell, you've heard of the concepts he created. As the legendary writer of Animal Farm, Orwell took the volatile politics of the time he lived in and used them to create twisted dystopias and savage satires. His 1984 is a cry for freedom still banned by repressive regimes around the world. Even now, nearly 70 years after his death, barely a day goes by without some media personality describing something as Orwellian. Perhaps more so than any other writer of his era, Orwell's work is still powerfully relevant today. Yet, how much do we really know about Britain's greatest modern writer? Born in the early years of the 20th century, Orwell was a man of fascinating contradictions. He was a socialist who studied at Britain's most elite school, a passionate defender of oppressed people who despised Catholics and homosexuals, and a committed atheist who, on his deathbed, demanded a Christian funeral. In today's video, we're traveling inside the mind of this complex man and discovering the origins of his most famous works. Given Orwell's veneration of the working classes, you might expect to hear that he was born in straitened circumstances. Well, actually, not a bit of it. When Orwell was born on June 25, 1903, in Mathare, Bengal, it was into a family with claims to former greatness. His great-grandfather had been a wealthy slave owner who'd married into the British aristocracy, leaving his family a fat pile of money to live on. Unfortunately, it hadn't quite been fat enough, and by the time Orwell first opened his eyes, his father Richard had been reduced to working for the British Civil Service in India. Despite this, both Richard and Orwell's young mother, Ida, tried to act as if they were still as rich as ever, creating what Orwell later called an atmosphere of impoverished snobbery. Not that Orwell was actually Orwell at this point. Orwell's birth name was Eric Arthur Blair. He wouldn't come up with his famous pseudonym until he was 30. Still, we're just going to go ahead and use George Orwell when referring to him throughout this video because, well, partly it's easier and partly because it's going to annoy any massive pedants watching. In 1905 or 1906, Orwell's life in India came to an abrupt halt when Ida took him and his sister back to England for their education. At first, this meant attending a small Anglican school not too far from Oxford. But then Orwell turned 11 and his mother shunted him off to St. Cyprian's. A fashionable preparatory school near the sea, St. Cyprian's was exactly the sort of place a respectable English family with aristocratic links might send their boy. Sadly, Orwell's family was by now so impoverished that they were anything but respectable, and his new schoolmates didn't let him forget it. In a future essay on his school days, Such Were the Joys, Orwell would paint his life at St. Cyprian's as one spent at the mercy of snobs piled upon snobs, with everyone fawning over those above them and sneering at those below them. Still, St. Cyprian's did its job as a preparatory school. By 1917, Orwell was prepared enough to win a scholarship to Eton, a private school that's long been synonymous with posh bastards. Not that Eton turned Orwell into the respectable pillar of the establishment that his parents were hoping for. It was while there that young Orwell began to cultivate his lifelong distrust of authority figures to immerse himself in the works of socialist writers. By the time Orwell graduated in 1921, he was ready to ditch the aristocratic pretenses forever. So instead of going to university, he went to Burma. For Richard and Ida, this was a little like hearing their son had ditched a future at Yale to work the deep fat fryer at a Chick-fil-A. Joining the colonial service was something Richard had done out of necessity, not out of choice. No graduate of Eton should have been headed to Burma. Yet, come 1922, that's exactly where Orwell found himself. He was a policeman in a colonial force occupying a remote part of Asia. He must have known he would hate it, and he did. But Orwell's time in Burma would prove to be more than just an exercise in masochism. Rather, it would be the place that transformed him from a melancholy schoolboy into a melancholy writer. When he later looked back at his time in Burma, Orwell would laconically report that nearly everyone there hated him. After his arrival in 1922, he had first tried to play the role of a colonial oppressor, only to discover that lording it over the Burmese made him miserable. So he began, instead, to try and befriend the locals. But while he enjoyed their company, the basic fact of his Englishness was a barrier to friendship. As a result, he lived in a twilight state, ashamed of his work and ashamed of his fellow colonials, but indelibly associated with them. Finally, in July 1927, while on home leave in England, Orwell realized he just couldn't take any more. He resigned from the colonial police. But rather than chuck the towel in and go to university, Orwell decided to give his parents another heart attack. Renting a cheap room in East London, Orwell dressed himself as a tramp and went off to live among the poorest of the working classes. He did that on and off for the next 4 years. It's been speculated that Orwell was trying to assuage the guilt that he felt from his time in Burma, the guilt of being part of a privileged elite actively oppressing others. Whatever the truth, right up until 1932, Orwell lived alongside tramps and beggars, sometimes loafing around London, sometimes picking hops in Kent. At some point, he made his way to Paris, where he spent a year and a half in biting poverty, working irregularly in hotels and grimy restaurants. Despite this, Orwell wasn't actually poor. While he spent a lot of time experiencing poverty, his life in the slums was not a constant thing. He'd spend a few weeks there, then return to his parents' home to decompress for a bit before restarting the cycle. It was this approach that gave him time to finally start writing. Not that he crapped out masterpieces from the go, though. Orwell's first tales were pretty awful, like the sort of prose that instinctively makes literary professors projectile vomit across the lecture hall. The few writer friends he had would actually read his painfully earnest stories together just to make themselves laugh. But Orwell stuck with it. From 1928 to 1932, he worked hard to improve his prose until he'd finally mastered a pared-down, minimalist style, which wasn't Hemingway, but at least didn't send anyone who read it into spasms of laughter. For his first book, that was good enough. Down and Out in Paris and London hit the bookshelves in January 1933. A lightly fictionalized retelling of Orwell's time among the destitute, Down and Out is famous today for its clear-eyed reporting of life at the bottom. In 1933, though, it was potentially scandalous, so much so that Orwell, or in some tellings his publisher, decided to release it not under his birth name, but under a pseudonym. And so it was that Eric Arthur Blair came to be known to history as George Orwell. While Down and Out didn't exactly fly off the shelves, it did earn some stellar reviews, good enough that Orwell's publisher asked if he had any more. We can only hope Orwell responded with a sly little smile. In his 3 short decades on Earth, he'd already amassed enough material to make himself famous. The next few years saw a stream of books from Orwell, all based on his own life. Down and Out was followed by Burmese Days, Orwell's bitter attack on the colonial system. But while Down and Out had been close to reportage, Burmese Days introduced one of the key characteristics of Orwell's fiction, a lonely protagonist trapped in an oppressive system who can't seem to escape no matter what he does. A year after Burmese Days came out, A Clergyman's Daughter landed based on Orwell's own experience working for a cheap private school. This was followed in 1936 by Keep the Aspidistra Flying, a semi-satire of Orwell's time living respected but penniless on the edges of London's literary scene. Yet if this book was slightly tongue-in-cheek, it was still haunted by Orwell's pet themes of poverty and the dehumanizing power of social systems. Which is why, the same year Aspidistra was released, Orwell got the offer of a lifetime. Victor Galansk was a wealthy left-wing publisher who wanted to know if Orwell would take a commission writing about poverty in England. For this, Galansk was willing to pay £500. To make it a little easier, in today's money, that would be like someone offering you $45,000 for a short book written however you saw fit. As Orwell probably didn't actually say, ka-ching. For the next 2 months, Orwell lived in the north of England, among destitute working towns gathering material. It was a grim experience, one comprising nights of bedpans and bitter cold. In Orwell's hands, though, it became the road to Wigan Pier. Wigan Pier is the book where Orwell famously proclaimed himself a socialist, a belief that he would hold for the rest of his life. However, it's also the book where Orwell took other English socialists to task for not living by their convictions. Victor Galansk was so disappointed that he would only publish it with an introduction that basically said, "Don't listen to this guy, he's a bit of an idiot." Still, Orwell got his £500, and on June 9th he was able to marry his girlfriend, Eileen Maud O'Shaughnessy. But while Wigan Pier may have seemed like the culmination of Orwell's life's work, events in Europe were about to send that life careering in a whole new direction. Back in 1931, Spain had abolished its monarchy, resulting in a new liberal republic. At first, the republic had ticked along, but then, in 1933, hardline conservatives had won the elections. In the aftermath, left-wing Catalans and Barcelona had attempted to secede from Spain, only to be crushed by General Francisco Franco. While Franco's bloody response turned him into a darling of the right, it alienated the electorate, so much so that conservatives lost power in 1936 to a leftist coalition. So Franco decided to just do away with elections altogether. On July the 17th, 1936, Franco launched his coup. Across Spain, military units rose up to depose the government. They were successful in many areas, but not in all of them. In Madrid and Catalonia, left-wing counter-coups kept the nationalists at bay. Suddenly, one part of Spain was under the control of hard-right fascists, and the other part was under the control of hardcore leftists. So the two sides did what came naturally. They executed tens of thousands of subversives in their respective areas, and then they turned their guns on one another. In Britain, the siren song of the Spanish Civil War called thousands of young men to go fight on the Republican side. On December the 23rd, 1936, George Orwell joins their number. Saying goodbye to Eileen, he stepped aboard a train, headed first for the English Channel, and then to Paris, and then on to Barcelona. By the time he returned, his life would have changed completely. It's impossible to overstate both how complicated and how bloody the Spanish Civil War was. On the bloody side, Republican mobs lynched clergy in the streets, while nationalists had their female enemies publicly raped. Although nominally under Republican control, Barcelona was actually home to multiple leftist factions, some of whom hated one another's guts. There were anarchists, Catalan nationalists, Trotskyites, Stalinists, non-aligned Marxists who viewed everyone with suspicion. There were soldiers armed by and under the direction of the USSR, while out on the battlefield, troops from Nazi Germany clandestinely trained Franco's guys. It was into this tangled web of alliances that Orwell found himself plunged headlong in January 1937. Although nominally there to cover the war, Orwell lost no time signing up to fight. Initially, he wanted to join the International Brigades, a communist unit fighting around Madrid. But this proved to be difficult, so instead he joined POM, those non-aligned Marxists that we mentioned a moment ago. In practical terms, this meant Orwell briefly trained in Lenin barracks before being sent out to fight on the Aragon front. But when we say fight here, we really mean stand around in a trench getting really, really bored. Aragon was not where the action was at all. After a couple of months, Orwell, he was climbing the walls. Again, he tried to join the International Brigades, but again, it got him nowhere. Finally, crawling with lice and bored out of his mind, Orwell returned to Barcelona just in time for the May Days. The May Days were a super complicated power struggle that played out on the streets of Barcelona between the communists, various anarchist factions, the Catalan nationalists, and various Marxist groups. The important thing is that during the fight, the communists went after the POM. This is how Orwell found himself sat on a Barcelona rooftop with a gun, defending POM headquarters as the left devoured itself. All told, maybe 1,000 people died in 5 days of street violence. But it was what came next that was really shocking. In the aftermath, the communists began a hard propaganda drive against all groups that had opposed them. Anyone fighting for POM was painted as a fascist. Suddenly, joining the International Brigades did not seem like the greatest idea. So Orwell went back to the front. And there, his story nearly ended. Lounging in a trench at Teruel, Orwell was shot by a fascist sniper. The bullet passed through his throat, nearly killing him. He lost so much blood that his death seemed inevitable. Just think, had that bullet been just a few millimeters over, we wouldn't be here right now. George Orwell would be a name known only to those teaching courses with names like Socialist Writers of Interwar Britain. Thankfully, though, the bullet passed clean through and Orwell lived. Taken off the front with permanently damaged vocal cords, he was returned to Barcelona just in time for everything to go south. By the end of May 1937, things in the city had reached the point of no return. The communists were moving against their enemies, and the POM was high on their list. Still badly wounded, Orwell realized he had no choice but to leave. Right now. In the end, he barely made it. As his friends from POM were assassinated or vanished into jails, Orwell and his wife managed to flee Catalonia for France just ahead of the clampdown. Had they been just a few hours slower, it'd have been a, well, goodbye place in history and hello, Socialist Writers of Interwar Britain. By the end of June, Orwell was back in Britain, safe from the inferno engulfing Catalonia. But his experience in Spain had changed him. While he was still a committed socialist, Orwell had discovered a new, abiding hatred for communism. It would be this hatred that would fuel his two greatest works. On April 1, 1939, Spain fell to Franco's forces, heralding a fascist victory. For George Orwell, it was just another piece of bad news in 2 years filled with it. On his return from the war, Orwell had written Homage to Catalonia, now regarded as one of the best pieces of war reporting ever. In 1938, though, it was seen as a betrayal of the left-wing, communist-leaning audience that had cultivated over the years. Despite great reviews, it barely shifted, failing to reach even Orwell's normal lows of 3,000 to 4,000 copies sold. Just before its publication, Orwell collapsed with breathing troubles. His subsequent diagnosis of tuberculosis only confirmed that he was on a downward trajectory. By mid-1939, Orwell was ill, unloved by many of his former readers, and deeply pessimistic about the future of Europe. When war finally broke out on September 3rd, it just seemed to confirm his cynicism. That fall, he tried to join up to fight the Nazis, but he was refused because of his tuberculosis. So he joins the Home Guard, half hoping it would become a vehicle for revolutionary change like Pom. If you've ever watched the TV show Dad's Army, you can probably guess how that panned out. Finally, in 1941, desperate to be of some help, Orwell joins the BBC, producing propaganda for its radio division. Today, Orwell's time at the BBC is legendary, not because of the work he did there, almost none of which survives, but because of the tales. For instance, it's said that 1984's mental torture chamber, Room 101, was named for a real room where Orwell had to sit through endless meetings. That's probably a myth, but it does show what Orwell thought of his time there. When he left in late 1943, he couldn't wait to see the back of the place. By 1944, both Orwell and St. Eileen were in a very bad place. Although they'd recently adopted a boy called Richard, both were sick with serious illnesses. On top of that, there wasn't a publisher in England willing to take on Orwell's latest novel, a fable about farm animals who revolt against their owner. And yes, with that, it's time to talk about Animal Farm. A deceptively simple satire on the Russian Revolution and its betrayal by Stalin, Animal Farm is the first of Orwell's two late-life masterpieces. But in 1944, it was also a potential embarrassment. Stalin's USSR was an ally, not wanting to hurt the war effort. No one wanted to touch the book. Eventually, Orwell managed to find an American publisher willing to take a chance, provided that they could wait until World War II was over. Orwell agreed, and on August 17, 1945, Animal Farm hit the shelves. It was an instant and colossal smash. Remember when we told you Orwell's novels usually sold 4,000 copies each? Animal Farm sold over 250,000 in its first year alone. For some reason, the fable struck a chord with readers in a way more complex fare, like Homage to Catalonia, never did. Maybe it was the timing, maybe it was the endless quotability, like the moments the pigs pronounce, "All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others." Well, for whatever reason, Animal Farm was the hit Orwell dreamed of writing. The money poured in, he became famous, the CIA even contacted him for permission to translate his book to Russian and smuggle it into the Soviet Union. Yet Orwell felt no joy at any of this. Just 5 months before Animal Farm's release, Eileen had died of cancer while Orwell was away on a newspaper assignment. Outwardly, Orwell bore her death with stoicism, but inside, he was a mess. An angry, guilty, bitter mess. Early next year, he took his adopted son Richard and left London for good. By now, his tuberculosis was nearly terminal. As man and boy headed to the remote islands of Scotland, it must have seemed like Orwell was shortly going to go the same way as Eileen. But not quite yet. Orwell still had one last book in him, and it was this final book, written as he drifted towards death's doorway, that would change the world. If you look up the definition of remote in the dictionary, you'll find a picture of Jura Island. Actually, that's a lie, we just wanted a more interesting way of saying Jura is pretty remote without just saying Jura is pretty remote. But Jura is remote, and the house Orwell and Richard moved into was remote even for Jura. It was 8 miles from the nearest phone, 25 miles from the nearest village. To get from there to London would take over 2 days. Naturally, Orwell loved it. For years, he'd been turning a story over in his head, a dystopian sci-fi fantasy that would mix together his thoughts on communism, what he'd seen in Catalonia, and totalitarianism generally. Now that he was effectively alone amid Jura's bleak wilderness, he could devote himself to the book entirely. For the next few months, Orwell worked 10-hour days, hunched over a small desk, chain-smoking cigarettes, and working on his novel. By February 1948, he had a first draft. Famously, he swapped the last two digits of the date to make the title 1984. That done, he promptly collapsed and nearly died of tuberculosis. Rushed to the hospital, Orwell was forced to undergo brutal treatments just to survive. He had air injected directly into his lungs, was given experimental medicines that caused an allergic reaction that nearly killed him. Desperate to get his last novel out before he kicked the bucket, he tried to hire a typist to take dictation. When no one responded, he simply sat in bed, getting weaker and weaker as he typed away. By the end of the year, he was back on Jura again, where he finished the second draft. Almost immediately, he collapsed again. From that point on, he spent most of what remained of his life in sanatoriums. By January 1949, Orwell was barely clinging to the world of the living, the effort of hanging in there itself almost killing him. Yet, hang on he did, until June 8, 1949, when 1984 was finally published. Almost immediately, the fight began over what it meant. For some, the novel's vision of Britain under a Stalinistic dictatorship that watches people's every move and polices their thoughts represented Orwell's final break with the left. For others, it was another satire of the USSR, this time one with far darker undertones than Animal Farm. Others saw in it a veiled attack on the Catholic Church's role in the Inquisition, while yet others thought it was an allegory for the post-World War II order, where conferences at Yalta had carved up the globe. But that's part of the genius of 1984. It can be reinterpreted in so many ways. A free market libertarian, a committed anarchist, an anti-Stalin communist, and an old stuffy British conservative could all claim it as their own. Sadly, none of them had a chance to ask if they were right. On January 21, 1950, George Orwell died of his tuberculosis, aged just 46. Barely 3 months before, he had married Richard's old babysitter, Sonia, the model for Julia, in 1984. One of Orwell's last acts was to ask for a Christian burial. Although he was a lifelong atheist, it seems he just couldn't refuse a traditional goodbye. Not that it seems Western culture will ever truly say goodbye to Orwell. In the decade after her husband's death, Sonia Orwell methodically republished his old and out-of-print works. Thanks to Animal Farm's mega popularity, people were now ready to read forgotten gems like Coming Up for Air, or essays like A Hanging or Shooting an Elephant. By 1960, Orwell's status as a literary icon was cemented in Britain. There were animated films of Animal Farm. In the 1970s, David Bowie first tried to produce a glam rock musical and then released a concept album based on 1984. Come the actual year, 1984, Orwell's work was so well known that it triggered a 12-month media frenzy. Today, George Orwell is a bona fide literary superstar, a novelist whose name is as recognizable as that of Hemingway. But even after all this time, the man himself remains a mystery. As we stated in our opening, Orwell was a man of many contradictions, an intellect that refused to be classified. Just type Orwellian into Google's news tab and you'll find left-wing and right-wing writers both using his name to decry their opponents. Remainers and Brexiteers, capitalists and socialists, everyone and his dog. They're all convinced that they've got Orwell sussed. But to assume you can just stuff Orwell into a box and label him misses the point. All his life, Orwell made a virtue of speaking his mind, even if it meant biting the hands that fed him, even if it meant playing devil's advocate. In the end, we shouldn't think of Orwell as something as simplistic as a left-wing writer or a right-wing writer. Perhaps we should just think of him as a writer who tried to tackle hypocrisy wherever he saw it, never compromising in his vision of a fairer society. He may have only lived a mere 46 years, but in his short time on Earth, Orwell managed to create complex masterpieces that defied interpretation. Come 2084, or even 2184, it seems likely that we'll still be reading them.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. Leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.